was ordered to pay more than $354 million and banned from running a business or applying for loans in New York for 3 years. His sons, Don Jr. and Eric, were each fined $4 million and banned for 2 years. It means the leadership of the family business is in doubt, and so is the future of some signature properties.
Trump is planning to appeal. Separately, he's been ordered to pay $83 million in a defamation case and has other cases pending. He's not running. After months of speculation, West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin says no to a presidential bid.
The centrist Democrat was considering a third-party run, but on Friday announced he doesn't think it's the right time and that he has no interest in playing spoiler. Manchin said he will instead focus on making sure we secure a president that can unite the country. Last fall, Manchin said he would not seek re-election in the Senate, giving way for Republicans to flip his West Virginia seat.
This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
It's Black History Month, and civic media supports the importance of this observance. But what do you really know about it? I'm Calvin Butenhoff, producer of The Earl Ingram Show. Our Echoes of Empowerment Black History Stories will offer thoughtful answers all month long. Now, here's Earl.
You cannot talk about Black history without including some of the early music and art which flourished in the 1920s and 30s. Time now called the Harlem Renaissance. But this new Black cultural identity was growing everywhere. Trumpet player Louis Armstrong moved to Chicago. Painter Henry Tanner was accepted into the Academy of Design. Musician Robert Johnson recorded the Delta Blues in Texas. Listen for another Black history story right here on Civic Media. I'm Earl Ingram.
Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station.
Fear you may be missing out? We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. Enjoy listening live or catch up by finding the podcast at civicmedia.us or wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts.
Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Sunny skies today, high temps near 30 degrees. Winds will gust out of the west at about 20 to 30 miles per hour. For tonight, still breezy, clear skies, 25. Sunshine and 39 on your Sunday, breezy once again. For Monday, mostly sunny, 43.
Currently 26 degrees.
Whether you're heading down Les Paul Parkway or fighting traffic on the interstates, this is The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
From the rolling bluffs of the Driftless region to the pristine shorelines of Superior in Michigan, from the Northwoods to the Kettle Moraine, Civic Media broadcasts across all of Wisconsin.
For all of Wisconsin.
Take a trip with us across the radio network to hear from communities throughout the state. This is the Civic Media Spotlight.
First up on this week's Civic Media Spotlight, we go to the Chad Holmes Show of WXCO, where Chad interviews Matt Tums of the U.S. wheelchair curling team.
Sometimes you're better off dead. There's a gun in your hand. And welcome back. Chad Holmes with you here on Bull Falls Radio, 98.9 and 1230. Online at bullfallsradio.com, mobile devices, and Alexa by searching WXCO, and on the Civic Media app. And we're very happy to welcome into studio, if you're watching on our stream on both our Facebook page and our X page, you see, normally it's me sitting around the table, but now we got a full table as we are very happy to be joined by Matt Toombs, who is a member of the USA wheelchair curling team that will be heading off to South Korea coming up in the next few weeks, and also joined from the Wausau Curling Club by Jim Forst. And gentlemen, thank you both for coming on in this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate
We're going to start off with Matt because you will be the one that's actually on the ice participating as a member of Team USA coming up in the next few weeks. First of all, I wanted to ask you about your injury, when you first became injured, and then how it connects with curling. But when did you first get injured?
I got injured in 2005. I fell out of a tree, and I became a T7 paraplegic. And I lived in a small community up north in Ogama, and I lived there for till 2009. And then I finished schooling through the MTC with an accounting degree, and I got my bachelor's through Upper Iowa. And then I moved to Wausau because there was more job opportunities. And my wife at the time in 2012 saw Learn to Curl at the new club they just opened up. And I went down there to try it out, see what curling was. I had no idea there was a sport like that. Club members just took me to the side, and we practiced different delivery techniques. That was on a Sunday, and the next night I joined the league and started curling.
Did you know rather quickly that this is something that you can get really good at? Because sometimes when people jump into any kind of activity or athletic, all of a sudden it just kind of clicks. Did it click quickly for you, where you said, hey, I'm pretty good at this?
The first year really had no real direction from another wheelchair curler until that spring in March. The national curling team was having tryouts in Janesville, Wisconsin at Blackhawk Curling Club. I found out about it, and I drove down just to meet the head coach, meet the team, and see actually how you deliver a stone properly from a wheelchair. Just hearing the word, gee, you could be a Paralympian one day, that was enough drive for me. And then the next fall, when the curling club opened back up, I was out practicing and throwing a lot of rocks.
How important was having curling as part of your recovery in terms of being active? Because I imagine that's one of the aspects where to be active, to have goals like this, to be able to reach the top and be part of and wear the flag on your jacket. How important was curling in the aftermath? Because that had to have been just a really difficult time.
It helped a lot. I was always active in outdoor activities, you know, before I was injured. And after injured, I still kept up. You know, I still hunted and fished, and I did some kayaking. But in the winter, kind of all shuts down because I wasn't a downhill skier, didn't want to right. mono ski and things like that. When I found curling, it made the winter months go so fast. And then I could go out on the ice by myself and just practice, you know. And then there was the team dynamics of it where, you know, it's a competition in sports, and you can do it with other people too. You can play wheelchair curling with able-bodied curlers. And
so you still are involved in leagues around here in Wausau then, correct?
Correct. I have one league on Monday night. I can't commit to more because I'm traveling a lot. Right. So Monday night's usually the night I'm actually in Wausau. Yeah, I curl with my girlfriend Shayna, her dad, and a couple other people. So it's fun. That's my only, I call it my non-competitive, so I can just relax and whatever happens, happens.
A social outing, in a
Correct.
Sense, right?
Yes.
We'll get more of your upcoming trips to South Korea and your previous part of the national team in a moment. I wanted to bring Jim in as part of the discussion on the Wausau Curling Club, because there's something that's real special about that club here in Wausau, isn't there? I mean, it really has got the fancy of a lot of folks here in central Wisconsin, hasn't it?
Well, we're fortunate in having a really great facility. Curling, you can compare it to bowling alleys a little bit in the bowling alleys have so many lanes, and the more sophisticated and modern bowling alleys have 10, 15, 20 lanes. We have 8 sheets to curl on, and the most curling clubs in Wisconsin are smaller than that. So we really have a fantastic facility that we're able to use all winter long. We're also able to bring in curlers from other parts of the state and the Midwest and actually around the United States.
How many leagues do you have? Because we're talking about leagues here in terms of, because obviously you bring in these special events, and that I remember last year you had a huge event coming in. I mean, it seems to be somewhat regular. How many people are I mean, I would call it, how would you call it, the casual curlers are involved in leagues here in Central Wisconsin?
Well, we have just over 400 members. We're recovering from the COVID pandemic, but we're getting back to where we used to be. We have leagues every day. I curl in a morning senior recreational league on Monday, Wednesday, Friday mornings. High schoolers come in and practice Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday in the afternoons. We have men's leagues, we have women's leagues, we have mixed leagues, open leagues as they're called, pretty much throughout the week and the evening. On weekends, that's where we have our special events like the men's invitational that I just mentioned. And this year, we have something just about every weekend from the 1st of November through mid-March. This coming weekend is the state high school curling meet here in Wausau. It's been in Wausau for years. Following that, we'll have our Silver Spoon Bonspiel, where members bring someone who doesn't curl to try to introduce them to the sport. We'll have the club championships in March. So we're really busy. We use the facility from basically October through March, and it's busy all the time.
Again, we're talking to Matt Toombs, who is a member of the USA Wheelchair Curling Team. He'll be heading off to the Wheelchair Worlds in South Korea in early March, and also Jim Force from the Wausau Curling Club. Matt, where have you traveled? Where are some of the places that you've been able to see as a part of because of this sport, you know, to take you around the world?
I've traveled to Switzerland, Scotland several times, Loja, Finland quite a few times. Was in Beijing twice, once for World Championships and then the 2022 Paralympics. I was in South Korea about in 2016. I think that was my first major trip with the Team USA. We call it the top eight. After team trials, they have 8 people. And then from the 8, they choose the 5 final for the team. And I was in the top 8 for like 3 or 4 years before I made it to the final 5. And all over Canada, numerous times. So I get a lot of air miles in.
Before you joined curling, had you been able to travel at all? Has this opened up the world in a certain way?
I think I was on an airplane twice before I started curling. So, yes, I tell a lot of people, if it wasn't for my injury, I wouldn't have traveled as much and done as much. I'd just be a 9-to-5 Joe like a lot of people. So I'm very blessed to found curling, and I got a great group of people that I curl with, and people, you know, you have more friends around the world than you realize.
The team aspect of curling. I mean, you have your job. Are you the skip? Is that correct?
Correct.
Could you explain what the skip is?
So a skip is like the quarterback of curling, for lack of a better term of it, because you're not in the house and you're telling the other teams what kind of shots to throw and what kind of strategy and how you want to set up the end to score points or, you know, steal or whatever. You've pretty much down there doing the strategy and communicating with the rest of the team on what kind of rocks you want them to deliver.
And there are different numbers. There's different competitions, correct? I mean, in terms of, is there double? I mean, could you explain maybe the different versions of curling that you're involved in?
Sure. The 4-person curling, in wheelchair, you have to have at least one person of the opposite sex on curling at all times. So it could be 3 women, 1 guy. Mm-hmm. We, our set up as three guys, usually typically, and one lady. So it's four person. Each person delivers two stones, starting from the lead, second, the third, and then the skip. And mixed doubles just became a Paralympic sport for wheelchair curling. This upcoming one will be the first time. And just 3 years ago, it was a world championship, was the first time for mixed doubles, which is only two people, mm-hmm. a guy and a girl. And they set it up different. So you play with five stones instead of eight. And there's two stones already in play. And it's a slightly different strategy. Well, it's quite a different strategy. But the delivery and making your shots, it's still the same, you know. You still gotta make your shots and figure out what strategy you need. But mixed doubles, each person, it's like they're not, like I'm not the skip. Me and my teammate Oyuna, we talk strategy together and figure out what kind of shots. Whereas in four person, the skip does a lot of it. But I mean, not saying the other three can't, you know, have an opinion or talk through shot scenarios and stuff. So.
But in the end, the skip is still going to be the one that makes that.
Correct. It's all you win as a team, yeah, and you lose as a skip. That's the same.
You listen, but then hey, yeah. Ultimately somebody's got to make that decision.
Right.
We're going to come back in about 2 minutes. I want to continue with a few more minutes with both Matt Toombs and Jim Force talking about curling and talking about the Worlds coming up, and also talking about the Wisconsin aspect and some of the other folks that I know, Jim, we're going to be talking to coming up hopefully in the next month or so as well. So we're going to come back in 2 minutes and talk more with Matt Toombs and Jim Force as we continue here on this Wednesday morning. The time is 8:48. I'm Chad Holmes. It is the Chad Holmes Show on Bow Falls Radio 98.9 and 1230.
The Chad Holmes Show is part of the Civic Media Radio Network and airs on WXCO weekday mornings from 8 until 10. To learn more about this show and all of the Civic Media programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows. This is the Shaw, WAUK.
It's Black History Month, and Civic Media supports the importance of this observance. But what do you really know about it? I'm Calvin Butenhoff, producer of The Earl Ingram Show. Our Echoes of Empowerment Black History Stories will offer thoughtful answers all month long. Now, here's Earl.
You cannot talk about Black history without including some of the early music and art which flourished in the 1920s and 30s. Time now called the Harlem Renaissance. But this new Black cultural identity was growing everywhere. Trumpet player Louis Armstrong moved to Chicago. Painter Henry Tanner was accepted into the Academy of Design. Musician Robert Johnson recorded the Delta Blues in Texas. Listen for another Black History story right here on Civic Media. I'm Earl Ingram.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Next up on this week's Civic Media Spotlight, we'll hear from The Earl Ingram Show. This week, Earl was joined by Claiborne Benson III, the founder and director of the Wisconsin Black Historical Society. You can catch The Earl Ingram Show across the Civic Media Radio Network from 8 to 10 a.m. or anytime as a podcast wherever you listen to them.
Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. I'm joined by my special guest, Mr. Claiborne Benson. He is the founder and curator of Wisconsin's Black Historical Society. And so, Claiborne, you can join us at 844-967-2789.
There's a continuation of things. For example, recently there is the threat of fraud, voter fraud. I mean, clearly there has been no proven evidence of voter fraud, and there have been Republicans who actually have done extensive research on whether or not fraud existed, or especially in the African-American areas, and there's no evidence of it. Not saying that there aren't one or two incidents of it, but on top, on massive fraud to influence our whole voting process has not happened.
Well, you would say nothing that would warrant all of these major changes that have come into existence.
That's right.
Based on really a lie.
Yeah, you're right. Based on a lie or a threat that they're concerned. And so you asked the question, how does this impact? How does this impact us today? Why should we be concerned about it? When we can have a system that say that a UW system take $32 million out of the budget, when education is the most important thing that has to happen to educate or empower people in general, Black, Native Americans, Hispanic communities, whatever, education is the key. If you don't want to see bad behavior, educate them. And that is what the university system was doing with the $32 million. And the system makes a decision to take that $32 million off the table and block all other kinds of events that take place that brings money into the African-American community. African-Americans are taxpayers, and they do deserve to have some involvement in the budget.
You know, so you talked about the $32 million. What is that?
The UW system.
Because of diversity,
that's
equity,
right.
and inclusion.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. They take that money out of the budget so that it does not go. And I'm sure that that had to have some impact. But clearly, the UW system is crucial to our survival. And our people need to have the educational assistance so that they can get an education.
So Claiborne, we tout around the world our voting capabilities, and that it's been said we've got the greatest political system in the entire world, and yet there's people are led to believe that it's dysfunctional because somebody didn't get elected that they wanted to get elected, and so we're willing to throw all that down the river and then disenfranchise other people.
That's right.
Based on a lie. I mean, it's just true. And all of this history that you're talking about that our forefathers and other people fought, bled, and died for, they just take that away with one fell swoop, and then people are silent on it.
Yeah.
It's just not right.
Well, it's not right. You asked the question earlier, when did all African Americans get the right to vote nationally?
Right.
When did this in other states as well? It's 4 years later, 1870 is when African Americans gained the actual legitimate right to vote, not just in Wisconsin, but in the entire United States. We get the right to vote.
You know, Claiborne, I would say without question that this knowledge, this history, that you are giving us right now, it's not just important to children. It's important to adults who didn't know.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes, it is.
I mean, so we go through our entire lives not knowing what transpired, what took place, why things are the way they are. And there's a history that you can follow that will point step by step how we got to where we are right now.
And so I started this out by the 1849 referendum vote being African Americans being denied the right to vote. But then as I ended, all of these little things are a continuation of methods to prevent African Americans from having the right to vote. I didn't mention two African American teachers hired in 1939 to be teachers in the Milwaukee Public School. Now, as far as people are concerned, at that point, there was no African-American teachers. These teachers are hired, and Samuel Cerf makes a decision that he wants to be reelected in the seventh automatic district in Milwaukee, and he is elected. He gets Black support to be elected. He's a white person, and he gets reelected as the 7th automatic district alderman. But he hires these two black teachers, and up until that point, there aren't any black teachers, and people are happy about it, and they support him. I guess that's I don't know what the answer is there. He is bribing people to elect him, because that's a big concern of the white aldermen during that period of time, and county supervisors and state representative, to be reelected into their districts, and yet he is. All of these are little methods in which have been to manipulate the outcome of the elections. And that's what we should not be having.
You know, Claiborne, this information is not to make anybody feel bad. There's nobody living today that was involved in any of those things. Yeah. So there's no reason that anybody living today should feel bad about what transpired back then.
Right.
The point of this information that you are giving is to make sure that people understand what did happen.
Yes.
And it is important. We can't say, well, that happened. We don't want to be reminded of it. Because other people's history, they make sure you're reminded of it, right?
They certainly are.
And never forget what happened. But our history, people want to just somehow say, well, you know, that happened back then.
Yeah.
No. I made the
point how these things are happening now.
Right.
How the things that happened then are influencing behavior patterns that are happening now.
All right. My guest is Claiborne Benson. He is the curator of Wisconsin's Black Historical Society and founder. 844-967-2789. We're going to continue this very important conversation.
Tell me that you love me, yeah.
Tell me something good.
The Earl Ingram Show is part of the Civic Media Radio Network and airs on select Civic Media stations weekday mornings from 8 till 10. To learn more about this show and all of the Civic Media programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows.
Broadcasting to Waukesha at 101.1 FM.
Broadcasting to Southeast Wisconsin at 540 AM.
This is The Shaw, WAUK.
CBS News Brief. At the Munich Security Conference, Israeli President Isaac Herzog has appeared with Hamas hostage family members and expressed hopes of getting more hostages released.
We have here families of the hostages, and I think we all express our pain and sorrow and sadness.
In Waycross, Georgia, a salute to Sergeant Kennedy Sanders. She was one of three soldiers killed in a drone attack last month in Jordan. Waycross High School basketball coach Mandy Linkenfelder.
From this day forward, we will carry you with us in our hearts forever. In fact, your Lady Gators just won the region championship for you last night.
In Loudoun County, Virginia, a firefighter has died in a house explosion. Fire Chief Keith Johnson says there was some good news, too.
There were two occupants of the house, and both of them were able to escape with minor injuries and have been released.
That explosion due to a propane tank leak and explosion. CBS News Brief, I'm Peter King.
A new film about Giannis. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. On Monday, a new highly anticipated documentary about the Bucks' Giannis Antetokounmpo will be released.
People might say I'm one of the best players in the NBA right now, but I don't see it. I don't feel it because I'm scared of losing all this.
It's the story of how Charles and Veronica Antetokounmpo fled Nigeria to Greece to raise their four boys and the struggles they faced. Giannis's mother, Veronica.
We left Nigeria looking for a better life in Greece.
The dream of every father is to give your children a better education.
As an immigrant, you are nothing.
We've always been outsiders.
we had to live in fear.
It's called Giannis, A Marvelous Journey. The film reveals how Giannis reacted to the news in 2017.
54-year-old Charles Antetokounmpo suffered a heart attack.
I said, I don't want to play no more.
Giannis, A Marvelous Journey debuts this week on Amazon Prime. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Sunny skies today, high temps near 30 degrees. Winds will gust out of the west at about 20 to 30 miles per hour. For tonight, still breezy, clear skies, 25. Sunshine and 39 on your Sunday, breezy once again. For Monday, mostly sunny, 43. Currently 26 degrees.
From the kennel to the coop, whatever the season, Fleet Farm has everything to keep your animals happy and healthy. From training your pup to sit season, to mastering those retrieval skills season. From clipping your horse for competition season, to keeping the backyard birds well fed season. And of course, loving your pets like family season. There's a reason people say, if Fleet Farm doesn't have it, you don't need it. Because we have it all. Fleet Farm, built for real life.
It's Black History Month, and Civic Media supports the importance of this observance. But what do you really know about it? I'm Calvin Butenhoff, producer of The Earl Ingram Show. Our Echoes of Empowerment Black History Stories will offer thoughtful answers all month long. Now, here's Earl.
You cannot talk about Black history without including some of the early music and art which flourished in the 1920s and 30s, time now called the Harlem Renaissance. But this new Black cultural identity was growing everywhere. Trumpet player Louis Armstrong moved to Chicago. Painter Henry Tanner was accepted into the Academy of Design. Musician Robert Johnson recorded the Delta Blues in Texas. Listen for another Black History story right here on Civic Media. I'm Earl Ingram.
The Todd Almost Show.
You look at Taylor Swift, she fought off the bitterness of defeat when she lost her records, when she was kind of duped by a manager. People who told her she'd never amount to anything. But it doesn't matter if you like her music or not. I'm a fan of anyone. Doesn't matter whether they're an artist or an athlete or just a common Jane or Joe. If you've overcome something in your life, you're a winner. If you've made it through, that's what it's all about.
The Todd Almost Show. Weekdays, noon till 2. On your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Your home for the Devil's Advocates. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6. On The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Up next on Civic Media Spotlight, we go to Up North News with Pat Kreitlow, where this week he spoke with officials from the Menominee and Cumberland school districts.
Welcome back to Up North News Radio on this Wednesday, February 14th, and welcome to Homeroom, our weekly segment on public education in Wisconsin and giving it the support that it needs to be as strong as it possibly can. I want to first, before bringing in our guests, just one more note on the topic I mentioned right before the break, and that was that in these nonpartisan school board elections, we are noticing more political involvement, often by county Democratic and Republican parties, but at least you know who's participating. There's an increase in the amount of money coming into these races by outside entities with kind of shadowy names. You know, it might be the Main Street, We Love Our Schools and Kittens and Puppies group. And what they really want to do is burn all the books in the district. So I'd much rather know what the entities are that are taking part in these. So anytime you see a political ad of any type and it's a generic name, be sure you don't take those things at face value and do a little homework and find out what all they are saying. And with that, let's bring in our guests, Heather Dubois-Bornon from the Wisconsin Public Education Network, as well as Dr. Barry Rose, superintendent in the Cumberland School District, and Abe Smith, school board member for the school district for the Menominee area. Good morning to all of you. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Heather, let me start with you. Just generally, just that general overview of school board races. And like I said right before the break, I'm sure that every one of these candidates would prefer that voters look at them just on their own as an individual and not what outside groups have to say. I know we can't guarantee that, but I wonder if you'd kind of echo that sentiment in how voters make their decisions on who to support in local school board races.
Yeah, thanks, Pat, and good morning, everyone. That's such a huge question for voters as they're trying to navigate who's running for school board. And I think your listeners are going to be shocked to hear this, but one thing that we've learned over the past couple of years is Wisconsin voters don't really like it when their school board races get super political. They don't like it when the political parties are overly involved in those decisions and when the focus seems to shift away from what little local kids need to what political folks want. And so we have been just kind of following with great interest the degree to which people who are running on, you know, very narrow or extremist agendas tend to be defeated in their school board races. Except where they're not, right? Where folks are running alone or unopposed, or they have campaigns that don't allow voters to really understand the truth about what the policy implications are of some of their positions. Sometimes those folks are getting elected, and in some places doing some strange governing once they are.
You know, we had a very good discussion about that in this segment a few weeks back, that it is often the candidates, if they are single issue candidates, whatever that single issue might be, tends to tell you they are not looking, they don't have a holistic, you know, all-encompassing view of the school district and of the kids and what they need. And that actually takes us into referendum season, that if people are focusing only on, say, the taxes issue and not the education issue, that might be rather telling, because these referenda are, for various reasons, all of them, you know, worthy, not wasteful when it comes to the kids, and for different reasons. In Cumberland, they're going for a capital referendum this month after a recurring operational referendum back in 2016. Menominee is going to be doing an operating referendum. And so we want to talk about both of those instances in this case. So let's start with Cumberland and Dr. Barry Rose, who's here, and tell us a bit more about the capital referendum that you're doing next week. You know, what it is, why you're deciding to do it.
Well, it's always it's always interesting going to a referendum. I think we all know that it, I don't know that there's ever a good time to go to a referendum, but for in Cumberland, our bond referendum, you know, it is time. And so we have a 65-year-old building that we've got our use out of. We ran this referendum in 2021 and we failed by 174 votes. The difference there is during that referendum, we had an auditorium and an additional gymnasium. And we're coming back now in February of 24, for $32.95 million, just a little more than it was at the $32.5 million, and we're getting less. And I think that's one of the things that we're really trying to communicate with our community, is that this isn't going away, and I'm not sure how much longer we can continue to kick the can down the road. We understand that it comes with a cost. In an investment, so we've been very clear about that. But that's the challenges of running referendums. They're not easy, and I think we're just trying to do our best job to answer all the questions before they get asked. And so we're happy to this point with where our campaign is at. It might sound kind of odd, but we're excited. I think we do our due diligence on the backside. We want voters to be informed, and ultimately they'll go on February 20th and make that decision.
Now, Abe Smith, as far as the Menominee School Board and the operating referendum that you've got going on, I think that you're framing this perfectly, that, you know, the voters should understand this isn't something the school districts are doing wrong. This is, as Heather and I have discussed many times, this is a statewide issue. This is a statewide condition that local voters, district by district, need to address as needs arise. So tell us more about what you're asking voters about next week.
Sure, thank you. Yeah, so the Menominee Area School District, we're a little bit west of Eau Claire up in northwestern Wisconsin. So the district is asking for a $4.2 million operating referendum, recurring. And what that means is we're asking the voters to contribute that much more into the budget each year into the future. And this is quite a challenge to explain to voters, because the district has a history of being extremely responsible with finances. Our superintendent has been really great at getting the most out of every dollar. And so a lot of voters are saying, well, if you're so good with money, why do you need this extra, you know, this extra cash? But to explain that, you know, across the state, so far, 82% of districts have gone to operating referendum. And it's likely that this year that'll go into the high 90s, because we know that there's over, of the 421 districts in the state, there are over 90 that are already scheduled for operating referendum between February and April. And probably that total is going to go into the well over 100 by November. So in 2024, we're looking at a situation where almost every district in the state will be either asking for or already using an operating referendum. And that's entirely down to state budgetary decisions. There were decisions made going back, you know, 20 years, but in particular, the last two budget cycles, where the district, where the state chose to make certain choices about the state budget, and those choices put the funding burden onto the localities.
And Heather, we have discussed this at length and have not been shy about saying why this is. Why is this a statewide issue? And it's because there is a legislature that's been in the same, under the same control for a dozen years. These are conscious choices to underfund these districts and force the school districts to look like bad guys going to the taxpayers.
Yeah, Abe got it exactly right. I mean, people are shocked when we show them the fiscal bureau documents that that prove that Wisconsin hasn't produced a budget for public schools that kept pace with inflation just since the last year's spending, since 2009, a point at which we were already seeing districts struggling with and tightening their belts after years of revenue limits that have been had imposed spending limits on them by the state. And so there's so much about how we do school funding that's wrong in this state, that's not aligned with student needs, but rather has to do with tax values and really increases the gaps across our districts. We've been advocating for reform in how Wisconsin funds its public schools for a long time, but now what we're seeing is the fiscal cliffs that so many districts were warning us they were coming up against is here. And with, you know, nearly 25% of districts potentially going to referenda in 1 year alone, I think that's a real wake-up call for the state that you can't just shift the burden to local taxpayers and expect schools to magically, you know, kind of resolve problems that have been caused by the state for decades.
Right. And of course, anytime you're talking about asking people to raise their taxes, it's like talking about inflation. Even if you say that inflation has cooled, well, if there's any inflation, of course, then that takes a little bit more out of people's wallets. Well, in the case of Wisconsin, and this, in my view, didn't get nearly enough discussion when the Wisconsin Policy Forum at the start of the year noted that the tax burden in Wisconsin, the share of Wisconsinites' income that is paid in state and local taxes last year, is as low as it's ever been. It's at about 10%. It has been so much higher in the past, but people say, well, taxes are still hard. And Barry, you've got to go out there and you can't say to people, well, your tax burden is the lowest it's ever been. They still feel like they don't want to pay more in taxes. That's an incredible messaging challenge for you or anybody in your position.
It is. And we've tried to do that as, like I said, as delicately as we can. But what we're really trying to, people, when they look at their tax statement, they typically look at the bottom number in the right corner and see how much it is. And what we've really tried to do is get them to look at their school tax. And for an example, you know, we levied, I could even go, yeah, I levied $7 million this year to our taxpayers. 10 years ago, I levied $7 million to our taxpayers. You can go back 20 years and it's less. So this notion of about, you know, I keep paying more, I keep paying more. I think the educational side of it is trying to get people to, and it's difficult to really understand their taxes, because as soon as they just hear referendum or they hear taxes, they figure it everything has increased. But you start to break it down into jurisdictions, you start to break it down into assessed value versus, you know, fair market value and those types of things. It can be confusing, but we've tried to do our best job to make them look at that, to understand you're not paying any more right now in your school tax specifically than you were 10 years ago, but it's a hard sell.
And so, Abe, what is the message that you try to cut through and get to the voters out there when it comes to the taxes, but also to their district and the role the schools play in the Menominee area?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like a lot of towns in Wisconsin, we're a fairly small town. We've got about 3,300 students in our district, and really emphasizing that the school is the center of the community, right? We've got, you know, facilities that people use year round. We've got the events, the concerts, the art, you know, this integration with the community is really what brings the community together. And what is a small town without an active school, without that dynamic interaction between the whole population going through the school? So that small town pride, I think, goes a long way. And that's something that really has cut through a lot of these kind of detailed financial messages.
And Heather, finally, for people that want to learn, you know, a bit more about this, they can go to wisconsinnetwork.org and learn more.
Yeah, we're here to support folks who are trying to get the message across about what local kids need to voters and others in their community who are wondering how they can support strong, thriving public schools. We have resources to support your referenda effort or to help educate voters on who's running for school board. And we would love to have you attend any of our free workshops or events and let us know how we can help. We also invite you to follow us on social media and join us at the end of the month, the week of February 26th, in celebrating Public Schools Day. This Public Schools Week is an opportunity for us to celebrate all the great things that are going on in our public schools and shift the attention back to all of the reasons we can celebrate our kids and their educators.
Yeah, absolutely. Todd Alba is going to be in here for me next week and is going to talk all about the activities that are coming up as, you know, we celebrate public schools. And frankly, the best way to celebrate them is to continue to support them, to, you know, put credibility in the messages that are coming from leaders like Abe Smith, like Barry Rose, and like others, you know, with whom we trust this, you know, responsibility of making sure that our kids are educated. I've only got just a couple of seconds here for each of you, Barry. Are there any other events or forms in any quick way people can learn more about the Cumberland referendum?
Yeah, they can. They can go to our website. We've got QR codes out there. We've had all the community meetings. We do have a last chance opportunity to see our building on Sunday the 18th. It's an open house for parents. Bouncy houses, childcare. We're really trying to get people in our building to see it. Beyond the shiny gym,
getting them involved. And Barry, very quickly, Abe,
sdmaonline.com. There's a great information site there.
That's perfect. So thankful for all that you do and hope that the community gets involved, asks questions, and show some real community pride for you guys next week. Abe Smith, Barry Rose, Heather Dubois-Bournon, thank you again very much. Great to talk to you all.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow is affiliated with the Civic Media Radio Network and airs on select Civic Media stations weekday mornings from 6 until 8. To learn more about this show and all of the Civic Media programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows. The Shaw, WAUK.
There's a small Wisconsin town where the population grows to 10 times its size every February.
Normally, we're about 2,600 people during Berkey Week. That gets up to 20, 30,000.
That's Blair Flickinger with the Foundation for the American Birkebeiner. The skiing marathon started with a couple of people carving a trail between Hayward and Cable 50 years ago. It's also a tribute to the ski culture of another country already hosting its own Birkebeiner. Is it Turkey, Norway, or Germany? The answer coming up.
There's a camaraderie that comes along with this event that is unparalleled.
A camaraderie between people who come to Hayward from around the world.
Make everyone feel like Hayward is their spot for the week.
So did you guess the Berkey was created as a tribute to Norway's 100-year-old race? And while our Berkey is a well-known winter event, it's still growing by adding other races all throughout the year. There's a slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for Matt Nair on Air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Closing out the first hour of this week's Civic Media Spotlight, we go to WGBW's Mino and the Mayor. They talk with Sandra Rank on the devastation that fentanyl is having in our communities, as well as the opportunity that she had to discuss the topic at the Capitol.
Hey, what? Welcome back. Mind on the Mayor here on a Friday morning, 7:21. Sandra Rank from Sandra Rank Realty is in the house, but we got something else to talk about that's very important to her and to so many people in the community. Good morning, Sandra. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm really good. How are you?
I'm good. But
good.
I'm going to just like, we're going to sit back and tell us about what's happened to you over the last 24 hours or so.
Okay. So yesterday I was in Madison accepting a Hometown of Hero Award. And I mean, if you know me, those awards give me hives. But the reason it was so important is I was able to speak in front of the entire state assembly on the subject of fentanyl. And because we're limited on time here, I'm going to jump right into it. So what I talked to them yesterday about was the last 2 years, Mitch died 2 years ago.
Your son.
Our son. And what I have done in the last 2 years is done the deep dive into fentanyl. I think people often ask me, like, why are you doing that? And my answer is, I think it's how I deal with grief. It's, for me, it has to make some sense, or I can't put it to rest in my mind. So, and I also really, 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 really don't want other people to be sitting in my spot. So, and I just want to really help our community. So I have done the deep dive into meeting with anyone who's anyone in this town in any position of power that could help our area with regards to fentanyl. So yesterday when I was speaking with the entire state assembly, I think if I could sum up that opportunity in one sentence, it would be really hard-earned intelligence meeting power, because those people are in the position to, they are writing our legislature, they are spending the opiate settlement money. So it was a really big opportunity. And what I shared with them yesterday were the things that I feel like are opportunities that we can do right here today, now, any community. So one of the things that I've been frustrated with over the last 2 years is when I go to talk to people, it's not like I'm talking to them saying, hey, you know, that carpet's gray. It's hard for me to do that. And when I talk with people and it feels like nothing is happening, it's frustrating. So yesterday when I was talking to people, I felt like they were listening. And one of the things that I heard, I talked to John Gard the night before, I talked to David Steffens before I went in, there are 14 pieces of legislature happening right now regarding fentanyl. So if there's a lot happening, but Jim can attest to this, the wheels of motion are slow in anything having to do with public policy. So here are the things that I've noticed that could be helpful. And I'm going to go, I mean, I could talk about each point for an hour apiece, but I'm going to keep this super fast and super brief. We can have more discussions later if people have questions. All right. The big thing is, do people need to realize like how big of a problem fentanyl is? And I really briefly, like literally 300 people a day in this country die. That's a 747 crashing every single day. It's a leading cause of death, 18 to 49. The U.S. life expectancy has decreased now, average life expectancy, the last 2 years in a row because of overdose deaths. So,
can I just throw something in? I just saw the stat yesterday about the worst day of the Vietnam War was the first day of the Tet Offensive, and we lost 246 troops that day, the worst day of the entire war. We have more people die from fentanyl every day than the worst day in the history of the Vietnam War.
I don't exactly have my number here. Let me see. Okay, in 2018 in this country, 31,000 people died of a fentanyl overdose. In 2022, 110,000 people died.
God. It's unbelievable.
So here's a big thing I learned in the last 2 years. Fentanyl isn't like any other drug. Fentanyl is really like a poison. It should be, in my opinion, one of the things that we could think about doing, the government can think about doing, is classifying it as a war chemical or classifying it as a poison. The reason to think about doing that is the penalties are different. And we need to educate people. They're not, this is 1 week in my life. Here are three things that happened in this, three calls I got this week. One child, not underage, overdosed on a fentanyl-laced pot. Second person died of a fentanyl-based opiate. Third person is highly addicted to fentanyl, doing things that is like a Mel Gibson movie. This is 1 week in our town. So, I mean, people need to realize this is serious. I think an idea is to have it be classified as something other than a drug. Secondly, we need to be having, like right now, we talked about this a little bit earlier. No one in this state is doing this. There's not a single person in charge of fentanyl. We have people doing it as part of their job, but we don't have like, and I know task force is not a big word people like, but for lack of a better word, we need intelligent eyes with intentional purpose, looking at what is happening with fentanyl all day, every day. My God, the minimum for our state. Honestly, I feel like every county should probably have someone looking at that. And we talked about this before. And I, when I've done my deep dives, I literally feel like I have a PhD in this. It's grieving moms that are running the show. Guess what? We're all, yeah, we're devastated and we want to help. But grieving moms shouldn't be handling something that's sinking a or kicking a 747 jet out of the sky every day. We need to have like really smart people doing this. So a task force would be really helpful. Next thing, massive, massive education. It is so duh to me on the border thing. I can't even go there. However, I can't control that. We can't control that. We can vote. That's all we can do. But we can control what happens in our community. I'm going to share a very quick story. I'm at the Northland, overlooks Republic Chalk House. They had a fire truck, a police car, and ambulance there. Walking to the window, our 7-year-old, a 12-year-old, and me, all looking out at this incident. 7-year-old says, "Oh my gosh, I wonder what happened." I said, "Well, I think it's probably someone had a heart attack, choked, or possibly an overdose." 7-year-old, "What's an overdose?" 12-year-old, "An overdose is when someone takes too much of a bad drug and they die." 7-year-old, "Why would anybody ever do that?" 12-year-old, "Addiction. That's why they would do that." 7-year-old, "I'm not saying anything." 7-year-old, "What's addiction?" 12-year-old, "Addiction is when people take that drug and they need it like they need to breathe and then it kills them." So in my head, I'm like, ding, 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 ding. There's our opportunity. It is education. We can talk about this when we come back from break, but what does that look like? Because people say we've done, one pill will kill. Say no to drugs. We don't need a slogan. We need actual hardcore education. I can talk about when we come back, a couple of those points, what those might look like.
Okay. Sandra Rank joining us. Really important stuff.
Thank you.
Back after this, Dennis McGladbag, Christy will be coming by right after this.
Mino and the Mayor is part of the Civic Media Radio Network and airs on WGBW and WISS weekday mornings from 6 until 8. To learn more about this show and all of the Civic Media programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows.
Keeping Southeast Wisconsin informed, engaged, and entertained. This is The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
Monday on Nightlight, I welcome author Beth Amos and Wisconsinology's Frank Anderson. Join us in our new time slot from 7 to 9 p.m. It's Nightlight with Pete Schwab.
Hi, my name is Maggie Dawn. You may have already heard that my 6 p.m. show is moving to 2 to 4 p.m. on the Civic Media Network.
And I'm Todd Allball, still taking care of middays from noon till 2.
Todd, what are you doing?
And I'm Dom, and Crudy and I are still kicking it from 4 to 6 p.m. across the Civic Media Network.
Dom, this is supposed to be about my show. I don't see why any of you guys...
We just want to be sure folks know precisely where to find you.
Right before the greatest radio show ever.
Until now.
Fruit.
Maggie Dawn, coming to your local station on the Civic Media Network.
2 to 4 p.m.
Right after me.
Oh, for crying out loud.
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Peter King. Russian media report President Putin has congratulated his military for recapturing the Ukrainian city of Avdiivka, calling it an important victory. That came hours after Ukraine's President Zelensky met with Vice President Kamala Harris at the Munich Security Summit. He's heard here through an interpreter.
I thank to all American people. I am extremely thankful to Mr. President Biden, to both parties and both houses in Congress for the vital support. And I'm sure that that together we can stop Russia. We must stop. Thank you for your attention. Glory to Ukraine.
The vice president acknowledges that congressional aid is not a given.
We must be unwavering, and we cannot play political games.
In Waycross, Georgia, her hometown has saluted Sergeant Kennedy Sanders, one of three soldiers killed in a drone attack last month in Jordan. Mandy Lingenfelter was her high school basketball coach.
Kennedy, you've sacrificed for all of us, and now it's our turn to pay it forward. You taught us how to laugh, smile, and win at this game called life.
A day after a judge ordered him to pay more than $350 million in a civil fraud case, former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley has been talking about Donald Trump's legal troubles during campaign stops in her home state.
He's going to be in court in March and April. He's going to be in a different court in April and May. He himself has said he's going to be spending more time in a courtroom than he is on the election trail. How do you win an election that way?
Weather radar shows.